Hello, good evening, and welcome to Seascapes. On tonight's programme, we'll hear about the fate of the Titanic sister ship, the Britannic. And we'll be at the opening of a new public area in Dublin Port and hearing about an initiative to open up the port to Dublin City. Now first, a couple of weeks ago, we heard from Dave Hennessy, who along with his wife Katrina, this year completed a four-year round-the-world trip on his yacht, Lara. Tonight, he recounts some of the scarier moments they had.
My wife and I are recently returned from a four-year round-the-world trip on our sailing boat, Lara. Last week, I addressed one of the most common questions we're asked, namely, where did you like the most? Tonight, I will answer the next most common question. Did you have any storms? Had you any scary moments? What was the worst that happened to you? I'm always surprised at this side of human nature. It's almost like people prefer to hear bad news. Anyhow, yes, of course, we had a few scares along the way. We had no engine making landfall and anchoring under sail in Barbados. Yeah, we were 6 hours away from being hit by Cyclone Pam in New Zealand. We were anchored in Sydney Harbour during what they called the storm of the century, and so on. But a few truly scary incidents stand out. One that remains with me is the time an open boat driven by a powerful outboard approached us at speed from over the horizon. We were between the Galapagos Islands and Ecuador, almost at the equator and hundreds of miles from land. As the boat approached, we could make out several men, heads covered, and I could only think, pirates, we were in trouble. They were soon alongside, but their hands extended, gesturing and begging for water and food. They were not pirates, but poor fishermen. Their heads were covered to protect from the sun, and we guessed they must have had a mothership supplying them and taking their catch. We gave them water, biscuits and all the food we could. Next morning, we came upon a similar open boat, no more than 20 feet long, and we were close enough to see them cooking on a Primus on the foredeck. So much for pirates. The worst scare the weather gave us was in New Zealand. We had been cruising around the Hauraki Gulf off Auckland. The New Zealand Met Office forecast a wet and windy 30 knots from the east for the next day. After consulting our guidebook, we decided to take shelter in Squadron Bay in Te Kuoma Harbour on the Coromandel Peninsula. The book said, one of the safest and most sheltered harbours in New Zealand, with excellent holding. It was indeed beautiful in a rugged way. Steep-sided hills with tall conifers stretching down to the rocky water's edge, forming a horseshoe shape. Well sheltered, so we thought. What we did not know was that 6 months earlier, they had a major weather episode similar to what befell Donegal a few weeks back. A month's rain fell in one night and destroyed roads, bridges, walking tracks. All this rocky rubble had washed into the sea, ruining the chances of an anchor holding. We laid our proven 25-kilo Bruce with 150 feet of 12mm chain, and by 3 a.m. the wind started up. The barometer read 1,010 and began to drop. By 11 in the morning, we had 35 knots of wind in our sheltered anchorage. By 3 p.m, it was gusting over 40, and our heavy tender and engine flipped upside down. At the same time, our anchor started to drag. We quickly righted the dinghy and reset our anchor. By now, the noise in the wind was deafeningly loud, and the water in the bay was turning to airborne spindrift. Another frighteningly loud noise announced another squall, and once again, our anchor dragged. Now, I was scared. We had no plan B and were drifting towards a rocky shore. We reset the anchor. Going to sea was not a safe option in the conditions, with night setting in. The state of the sea in the bay indicated at least 50 knots, or storm force 10. We were getting 45 knot gusts by now. I decided to get all the rope I had aboard and brought it ashore and tied it around a tree and then paid it out and secured it to Lara's bow. With each gust, the rope took the initial shock load and the anchor and the chain held. Fingers crossed. Would the rope chafe on the oyster shell covered rock? Would the wind stay in the east? Would the rope part? So we settled down to an anxious, sleepless night. Around 2 a.m., the noise of the wind and the gusts started to ease. The barometer read 1,000, but had steadied. By 3 a.m., there were more periods of quiet than loud madness. By 6 a.m., we could gratefully say we were over the worst of it. Later that morning, we sailed for Auckland. Once clear of the steep-sided harbour, we had radio and Wi-Fi reception again and listened to the Met Office giving a severe weather warning for the area, with winds gusting to storm force. Yeah, a day too late. Sometime later, I asked a local fisherman what was the story with the New Zealand Met Office. They forecast 30 and you get 55. He laughed. Yeah, he said, if we have a youngster around here who's inclined to tell fibs, we warn him or her. You keep on like that and you'll end up working for the New Zealand Met Office.
And you can read Dave Hennessy's full account of the trip on Lara on lara456.wordpress.com. And speaking of round-the-world trips, best of luck to all competitors in the Volvo Ocean Race, including our own Annalise Murphy, which gets underway this weekend. Now, the criticism of the New Zealand Met Service couldn't be put to our own Met Service. Met Office warnings on Hurricane Ophelia allowed seafarers and boat owners alike to prepare for the worst, and huge damage and loss of life was avoided. But a word for those sailors who were rescued on their 10-metre yacht by the Rosslare lifeboat at the height of the storm on Monday. They were underway from Southampton to Dublin and obviously ignored the storm warnings. They sent out a mayday, and you can see the video of the rescue on the RNLI website. It's a tribute to those lifeboat volunteers involved. Almost incredibly, that same yacht was rescued again 24 hours later by the Arklow lifeboat when they suffered engine failure on their way to Dublin. We've tried to contact the owners of that boat without success. Last week, Dublin Port opened a major new part of their initiative to open the port up to the public. A park surrounding the port centre on Alexander Road is a major new public space for the city. Seascapes went along to the opening, where singer-songwriter Lissa O'Neill performed a specially written song.
I am Jim Kelleher. I'm the project manager at Dublin Port Company, the client for the project to open up Port Centre.
So your Port Centre here is the new gateway to Dublin Port. Tell me about it.
Well, I suppose it's a project that was born out of our master plan, and one of our main objectives was to reintegrate the port with the city. So that means taking down barriers that had probably evolved and emerged over a couple of hundred years. We were, I suppose, marooned behind stone walls for the best part of 30 years.
And a guard at the checkpoint.
And a guard checkpoint close by us. But we decided to look at it in a new light, which... with the aid of good design, good architectural design, consideration of the built environment that we had around us, and appreciation of that, all the facets of it, and an intention to allow the public and people come in and see what we do in the wider port area.
So at the entrance to Dublin Port here now, you've opened an architecturally designed plaza. You have several pieces of sculpture here as well.
Yeah, we do. We've... the podium, which I suppose up until about a year ago had literally tumbleweed blown across it. We now have a fantastic 4 metre stainless steel ball that was fabricated in China.
What does that represent?
It's inspired by the historic time ball of old, which was on the Ballast House up on Westmoreland Street, corner of O'Connell Bridge, which used to drop daily at 1 p.m. and the ship's masters would set their watches by that. It represents that. We have fantastic seating, planting, and more importantly, we have a sense of place here now and a sense of space that people can come and appreciate the port operations that they can see from here. And it pays homage to the original architects of the building, Scott Tallon Walker, 35 years ago, and the commissioning authority at the time, our predecessors in the Dublin Port and Dock Boards, and the vision they had for this building and its landmark status.
Yes, my name is Richard McCormick, and I'm the president of the Maritime Institute of Ireland, which owns the National Maritime Museum in Dunleary, and effectively I'm the chairman of the board. That's what the title really means.
You have a particular interest in how Dublin Port, in comparison with other ports in other cities in the UK in particular, interacts with the city.
Yes, indeed, because only last week I was over in the United Kingdom. I visited Grimsby, which is a port. As a young man, I used to be a fisherman. We fished out of there, working up north, Iceland, Greenland, Spitsbergen, and all the other places. And then I went across to Hull, and what they call the UK Maritime Heritage Forum was being held there. And I could see a contrast. I'd lived in Hull when I came ashore with the collapse of the Cod Wars, and I was absolutely stunned by the amount of development that's happened in the town. And what has happened in it is all to do with trying to develop their maritime heritage. They've looked at it very seriously. They have a tradition that probably goes back to Viking times, just like ourselves, and they have seen that there's a potential for tourism there. and they developed all the local amenities that have a historic connection with the sea in a way that is attractive to the ordinary person who really doesn't have a maritime background but is still interested. In other words, the type of person who would be the curious type of visitor to a town or a city like Dublin, and they're doing extremely well out of it. And I think it's a way forward. And what I like about the development here is that Dublin Port has actively tried to reconnect itself with the city.
They've done that very, very actively.
And I would remember it now, going back, my father was the managing director of Rathburn's Candle Factory in Eastwall Road, long since gone. Founded, by the way, 4 years before Columbus discovered America. That was the unique selling point when he was in America. But I remember as a child wandering down the docks here and never being frightened or anything like that, and seeing the most enormous amount of activity. There would even be horse and carts, there'd be lorries, there'd be men unloading ships the hard way with banana hooks and all the rest. And these were the salt of the earth. And the problem is that when things changed to, say, containerization, very often these people got left behind. But the people were still there, and the descendants are still there. And it's great to hear, for example, tonight that the Dublin Docklands Preservation Society was mentioned, because they are trying to recover some of that aura of what was in the past and bring it out again to the people. It's gone forever, just like a lot of the fishing is gone in places like Grimsby and Hull, but it is still an important part of our heritage, and people do want to hear about it.
So in this plaza here, and this new centre that's been opened today, people can walk in, explore a little bit of our history.
Yes, I actually wouldn't know Dublin Port all that well. Believe it or not, I actually did fish in Dunleary with a gentleman called Brian Crummy, who was the top skipper at the time, in a ship called the Nordcap. And we used to come up here, you used to have to get out of Dunleary in a southeast wind. It was too risky to be leaving a boat there. She'd get smashed up. So we'd move out into, we used to go all the way up to Buttbridge, which seems amazing in this day and age. But we would not have had a huge connection with Dublin Port itself. But at the same time, it was our native city. And it was nice to be actually tied up at Buttbridge and be able to go up and do all the socialising that had to be done up there. But it wasn't part of our lives as such. But I'm very pleased to see we're reconnecting, or the Dublin Port is starting to reconnect with the city. Because I think that's what was lost. And if you want to develop it, you have to have the people behind you.
One piece of film shown on the night was about the cultural heritage of the Dockers. These former workers are telling of the culture of nicknames.
Eight Bobby, the Wicked Chicken, Skipper Don,
Salt Fox O'Connor,
Big Apple,
Little Apple,
Crab Apple,
The Goat,
Joe the Goat.
I can't remember where. Can you remember?
He was always called that. He never spoke proper, or he never said that out straight. It was always arse about face. He got more hoydens in the school than anything else. If he met it all called the Mount Joy, he wouldn't
Urban Science.
The Great Philosopher.
Foot and a half.
Chico Buckley.
Call him the Loch Ness Monster or something after that.
But once it was said, and once the stamp went on you,
stuck.
That was it forever. You never got rid of it again. That was it. You've had it. And the more you talked and tried to contradict it, the worse it got.
By the jingo.
Pion Louis.
Be the dyke.
Ox born.
Chicky May.
Man of a thousand faces. Like in a factory, if you said the things that were said on the docks as a norm, you'd probably get sacked.
The man from Laramie.
Fingers.
Buckets of blood.
Thumb.
Flight careless.
Shoulders.
Diesel. Diesel do for the kids. Diesel do for the wife.
Sissy, your old Felicity was always a cowboy Phillips. So they called them Bronco. And Sissy, that's what you're called, Bronco. So the name went on. I have a son now, a grandson now. He's into the boxing. And when he's boxing, come on, Bronco.
Remy Martin.
Nankles.
The Bombardier.
Knees.
Bogey Dixon.
The bleeder looked dead. He was the whitest man you'd ever see.
They always call him Wopes, Chinier, Bunny Fitzsimons.
Lumps. I'd say it's down to divilment. They were the greatest group of wind-up merchants you'd ever come across. And it shortened the day. The crack was absolutely 90.
Muddler. Billy the Greek. Quacker Nugent, the Gannet.
Don't you get too much information now?
Eamon O'Reilly is the Dublin Port Chief Executive.
Well, the project has been, this particular one now tonight, has been about 1 year under construction, but it actually is part of what will be a 10-year initiative.
And that initiative is to physically open the port to the city. I talk a lot about trying to make the connection again in terms of the consciousness that people have about the port. But we also need to do something very physical and very tangible. So we started just nearly a year and a half ago with the diving bell on Sir John Rogerson's Quay. That's going to be the first stop of nine stops of a trail that will take people from John Rogerson's Quay through the heart of the port and right over to the Talca estuary to a 4 kilometre cycle and pedestrian route, which we will start construction on next year. So where we are tonight is the fifth stop of the nine stops on this trail. So three of them are in the bag already. Another two of them are scheduled to be built within the next couple of years as part of our Alexandra Basin redevelopment project.
You talk a lot about reconnecting the city with the port because it has been cut off for many years and you want to change that.
It has been, and the analogy that I use, I think the disappearance of the port from the city, it really is like knocking down a Georgian street in Dublin. The only difference being we can do something about the broken link. We can rebuild it, and that's what we're doing with the initiative here tonight and the wider initiative for the Dublin Port Trail.
Minister Pascal Donoghue, you and I know each other from my day job. We're both wearing different hats tonight. This is an amazing development in your own constituency.
It is, and the work that Dublin Port have been doing now for quite a while in relation to opening up the port to the rest of the city, I think is only becoming visible now. Last year they enabled and supported an unbelievable album of music called Starboard Home that led to a performance in the National Concert Hall. And it was really about reminding us all that we are a port city. And because we're a city built around the port, I think we haven't appreciated how central the port is. And Dublin Port have realised that themselves. And what they're trying to do is literally take down the walls and open up the port. And what we're seeing here tonight and what they've been doing over the last year is a sign of it. And there's something magical about what happens here. I came down here at 4:30 one morning and saw the life that's down here. But it's a buried life by the sea.
But and until now, you couldn't walk in here. Now you can walk into this big public plaza and look at what's going on.
You can walk in here, you can see the lovely sculpture that they have here. And I think that by as residents, as Dubliners come down here, they'll realise that the birthplace of our city is here and near here. But they'll also realise that one of the kind of pulsing centres of the life of our country is Dublin Port. As a piece of infrastructure, it's unbelievably important to our country, but also as a hub of activity, it's central to our city. But it's been behind walls for too long, it's been hidden for too long. And what Eamon and his team and Lucy, who's the chair of this port, are doing is trying to open it up, and it's wonderful.
You mentioned when you came down here at 4:30 one morning. I've come down here myself at that time. It is an incredible place.
There's a little bit of magic when you come down here when Dublin Port is in full flow. And I was remember coming down here one morning and I saw a vessel docking that had come directly from Africa. And, you know, when we think about a global world, we think about the planes, we think about the digital economy. But actually, the global world began with a container, and that container is on a ship. And when those ships are arriving to Ireland, most of them come to Dublin Port. And to be here, to see the activity, to see the movement, all happening on the sea, on a port, brings to life to you how interconnected our country is with the outside world. But it's a physical interconnection. It's not all about what happens over a cable or an electronic pulse. It's what happens on a vessel. And that's what this is all about.
River up the machine until it stops.
Lissa O'Neill with her tribute to dock workers, Rock the Machine. Our regular contributor, Hugh Oram, joins us again. And this week, Hugh has been looking back at the sister ships of the Titanic.
Everyone knows about the Titanic and the fate that befell her on her maiden voyage in 1912, but her three sister ships are less well known. Amazingly, one is perfectly preserved and is on show in Belfast. The first of Titanic's sister ships was the Olympic, built at Harland and Wolff in Belfast between 1908 and 1910. When she was launched, she was the world's largest liner. She made her maiden voyage to New York in 1911, a year before the Titanic set sail. And the Olympic was almost identical in size and appearance to the Titanic. Less than the month after the Titanic sunk, the Olympic was fitted with many extra collapsible boats. Until then, she had only the regulation 16 lifeboats, a fraction of what were needed. But immediately after the Titanic disaster, the regulations for lifeboats were swiftly updated. Many of the collapsible boats, however, that were installed on the Olympic were rotten and unusable, sparking a near mutiny among the crew on board. Then in 1913, the Olympic underwent a major refit that saw an outer skin being built around the hull. And once she had her double hull, she was virtually unsinkable. She was destined to be a great ocean liner, but the transatlantic trade collapsed with the start of the First World War, and in 1915, the Olympic was requisitioned by the Royal Navy to become a troop carrier. From 1916 onwards, she carried many Canadian troops to the battlefronts of Europe. And the following year, 1917, she started carrying American troops to Europe after the US had entered the war. During that war, the Olympic had an amazing appearance, as her hull and funnels were painted with dazzle camouflage to deter enemy warships and submarines. But she managed to survive the war unscathed, and having carried over 200,000 troops, she had been dubbed Old Reliable. After the war, she was refitted and returned to transatlantic service, the job for which she had been originally designed. During the 1920s, she carried many famous, rich people to and fro across the Atlantic, and her onboard guests included everyone from members of the British royal family to Charlie Chaplin. But during the early 1930s, the Great Depression had a big impact on the liner trade across the Atlantic, and by 1933, the Olympic started running at a loss. In 1934, the White Star Line, which owned the Olympic, was forced to merge with Cunard. Work began on building two new superliners, the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth. And ageing liners like the Olympic were sent to the scrapyard. When the Olympic set sail for the Breakers Yard in Jarrow in 1936, huge crowds turned out to see her sail on her last voyage. While the Olympic had managed to last for more than 20 years after the sinking of the Titanic, that liner's other sister ship, the Britannic, didn't fare so well. The original plan was for her to be called the Gigantic, but in the end, the owners settled on Britannic. She was laid down at Harland and Wolff in 1911, just a few months before the Titanic set sail on her one and only voyage. The Britannic wasn't completed until 1915. She too was destined to be a luxury liner, but within weeks of being completed, she was requisitioned as a troop carrier and as a hospital ship. The Britannic had made several voyages to transport wounded military personnel from the Middle East back to Britain. In November 1916, she set sail from Southampton, heading back to the Middle East. And then on November the 21st, 1916, when she was sailing off the coast of Greece, relatively close to Athens, she was sunk by German mines. In just under an hour, the Britannic sank. The waters where she went down were much warmer than those where the Titanic sank, and the Britannic had many more lifeboats, and help arrived much quicker than had happened with the Titanic. Just over 1,000 people on the Britannic survived the sinking, while 30 perished, a complete contrast to the death toll for the Titanic. And the wreck of the Britannic still lies there today, the largest shipwreck of the First World War and one of the largest anywhere in the world. The third sister ship of the Titanic was the Nomadic, built at Harland and Wolff in 1911 and designed to be a tender to take passengers out to the Titanic and the Olympic, both of which were too large to dock in Cherbourg. The Nomadic was a quarter of the size of the Titanic, a diminutive version of that doomed ship. And during the First World War, the Normandic was requisitioned by the French government and then continued as a tender until 1934, when the port at Cherbourg was enlarged. During the Second World War, she went into service for the Royal Navy and eventually returned as a tender because Cherbourg Port had been so badly damaged during the war. And eventually she found a new mooring on the River Seine in Paris, where she became a floating restaurant, and she survived there for the last quarter of the 20th century. Eventually, the Normandic was returned to Belfast in 2006, and a big restoration program began. This was completed and the ship is now on permanent display, the only survivor of those four ships built for the White Star Line. And now work has been completed on restoring the drawing offices at Harland and Wolff, where the Titanic and these other ships were designed. The drawing offices are being restored to their original state and will be open to the public, the latest part of the huge Titanic project in Belfast.
And that's it for Seascapes for this evening. Join us again at the same time next Friday. All contacts and information for items on the programme are on the website rte.ie/seascapes, and all programmes are podcast. If you're on the water this weekend, remember to stay safe.